It's Friday, January 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, global financial markets drop again.
It pushes us to an area where military responses are considered more thoroughly.
Responding to North Korea's nuclear test may change as capabilities grow. Also ahead, we explore how federal authorities are seeking to end an armed standoff in Oregon. An Australian entertainer makes a fashion statement. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. The focus of investors worldwide is on China, where regulators suspended trading on China's markets for a second time this week, Thursday, after markets nosedived over 7%. The so-called circuit breaker measure introduced by Chinese regulators followed sharp declines in stock prices last June, and it kicked in just moments into the trading day. While conventional wisdom suggests it reflects investor concern over the weakening Chinese economy, falling world oil prices and geopolitical tensions, Shane Oliver, chief economist at AMP Capital in Sydney, told VOA it really is the circuit breaker mechanism itself that's causing investors to sell off unwanted shares quickly.
I think what's happening here is that whenever there's some bad news or some worries, what's happening now is that Chinese investors think, well, I better sell early on if I'm going to sell at all, otherwise the circuit breaker will kick in and I won't be able to sell. So consequently, we're seeing the market pushed up to that level of a 7% decline each day, and that's causing the circuit breaker to then be triggered and the market to be shut down for the day. So in a way, it's become self-fulfilling.
The Chinese government has also been guiding the yuan currency lower, an apparent sign that authorities are prepared to allow it to weaken in a bid to boost flagging exports. U.S. stocks were also lower Thursday. However, global stocks trimmed losses after the Shanghai and Shenzhen stock exchanges said China would suspend the circuit breaker as of Friday. Earlier, International Edition host Susan Yaki was trying to make sense of the markets and had one question for VOA senior economics correspondent Jim Randall.
What is going on?
Well, fear. A long time ago,
yeah,
a president
really?
Told us we had nothing but fear itself. Well, we have fear here. And the fear is that China's economy, which has been an engine of growth for all these other countries that depend on China as a place to sell things, as a market, that China's economy is slowing down even more than we first thought. And that was reinforced when the currency, the renminbi, the yuan, the value of that was cut to the lowest it's been since, I think, August. But it was the important thing is not the absolute value of the Chinese currency, but it's the fact that the authorities pushed that value down in a bid to try to make their exports more competitive, and the investors figured that it was only being done because Beijing figures the economy is even weaker than the rest of us thought.
But should we panic?
Panic is always a bad idea. I think you should keep an eye on fundamentals. I mean, I'm not in the business of giving out financial advice, but the people who do give out financial advice say that you should not sell as stocks plunge, because you're going to be selling at a loss, and then you're going to try and get back into the market eventually, and you'll be buying when the value is up. You can really hurt yourself twice by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not qualified to give financial advice. I just sort of parrot it.
Okay. Well, is this going to continue for a long time, or are we going to possibly tomorrow or maybe even next week, will things start to turn around, or...
You know, if I knew the answer to that, I would not be riding the metro to work. I would be somebody would be bringing me to work in a nice long limousine. I have no idea, and neither does anybody else.
Well, while Jim rides the metro, we're going to turn to our social media segment. The online community, of course, is talking about yet another day of global market plunging. And International Edition's G. Abby Lee is right here in the studio to tell us the latest. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. I mean, when does this end? I hope you don't have too many shares listed in either the Shanghai or the New York Stock Exchange.
Or any shares, really, at this point.
Exactly. The fresh plunge in China's stock market is having ripple effects around the globe. The Dow Jones Industrial Average started on its worst ever start to the year, and Europe was not an exception. it's very strange because many credit markets and commodities are also taking a beating, with oil prices falling to, get this, 12-year lows.
Well, we've seen the Chinese government, including the state media, trying to intervene on this situation. Mm-hmm. But how is the public reacting to this?
For that, we have to turn to Weibo, China's answer to Twitter. Jim, I was initially guessing that it will probably not be that much information on Weibo because of, you know, Beijing censorship. But I was pretty surprised a lot of the users there were able to make fun of and even criticize the circuit breaker. The trending hashtag right now is hashtag A-shares-circuit-breaker. And A-shares are shares of the renminbi Chinese currency bought and traded on the Shanghai and Shenzhen stock exchanges. Hmm.
So what are the Chinese investors saying there?
Well, understandably, they're not happy. One user wrote that since the Chinese stock markets already had a system in place to halt trading, the introduction of a circuit breaker was, quote-unquote, superfluous. Another user wrote, "This is what happens when the government tries to intervene in the market," and added sarcastically, "Long live the Chinese stock market." There were, however, some positive responses. One user wrote, "Does a circuit breaker have anything to do with the slumping A shares? Although the circuit breaker doesn't serve a major purpose, the shares could have fallen by 9 to 10% now if not for it." Now, if I were to introduce just one more, I think it's common knowledge that trader's salary is not shabby at all. And, well, you know what? Let's just read the comment by a student. I think it should be pretty self-explanatory. "After the Chinese stock markets introduced circuit breakers, I am even more determined to work for a securities firm after I graduate. After all, I only have to work half an hour every day." Jim?
Well, that's not a bad strategy. Thank you, G, for that analysis. You can follow her on Twitter at G Abby Lee or at our program's account at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. The United States and its two key Asian allies, Japan and South Korea, are pledging what a South Korean official calls the most powerful and comprehensive sanctions against North Korea following its fourth nuclear test Wednesday. President Obama discussed the matter by phone early Thursday with South Korean President Park Geun-hye and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. South Korea has also announced a resumption of cross-border propaganda broadcasts the North has previously called an act of war. Korea expert David Straub of Stanford University tells VOA's Victor Beatty he doubts the council's early and tough response will resort to the kind of economic sanctions that appeared to be effective in drawing Iran to the negotiating table over its own nuclear program.
I'm very doubtful that China and Russia, which have veto power on the council, will agree to such strong measures. I think they will probably agree to significantly strengthen sanctions, but won't go for an all-out financial war against North Korea. However, the United States Congress, especially the Republican opposition, is looking very seriously at some sanctions legislation that would impose Iran-type financial sanctions against the North Koreans.
Well, they seemed to work the last time the Bush administration used them late in that administration.
Well, that's the conventional wisdom, and it certainly angered the North Koreans. But I myself have never seen proof that it really seriously affected the North Korean economy. But it did certainly make the North Koreans very angry.
Those sanctions also could hurt Chinese banks. so they could have a ripple effect beyond North Korea.
That's right. And that's part of the reason I believe the Chinese will not support those sanctions in the UN Security Council. The United States government also has to weigh this very carefully. If it goes for these types of sanctions and in the process really upsets the Chinese, that could affect U.S. cooperation with China, not only on other aspects of the North Korean nuclear issue, but also on all the many other issues on the U.S.-China agenda.
Stephen Norper of the New York-based Korea Society says what is significant about the latest nuclear test is not whether it was a hydrogen blast or a boosted atomic explosion, but the modernization process apparently underway in North Korea.
The idea of miniaturization and enhanced capabilities can pose a real threat, both in terms of security, and it limits the types of responses that can be made in the international arena, and it pushes us to an area where military responses are considered more thoroughly. And so that raises the stakes all around. So it could be considered normal nuclear development, but it's a dangerous, dangerous game.
How serious a setback is this for global anti-proliferation efforts, given the July nuclear agreement with Iran?
It's a setback, certainly. The emphasis and the push really should be toward nuclear non-proliferation, if not the stated goal of denuclearization. And that's should still remain probably the more realistic goal at this point. But limiting DPR capabilities is really at the fore of priorities, not just for nations like South Korea, the United States, and Japan, but really and increasingly for countries like China. China's the largest loser in this particular case. Chinese citizens are very frightened of nuclear fallout from North Korea. You will see, I'm sure, an amassing of PLA forces toward the border in coming days. And the Chinese have very vociferously, through their foreign ministry, condemned this test. And the Xi Jinping administration appears, frankly, to really be at a very strong breaking point with North Korea over this. We'll have to see how far that goes.
Stephen Norper says concerns over the North's nuclear direction over the next 10 to 20 years, if left unchecked, could give new impetus to restarting suspended six-party talks on denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. Several days into the standoff, the takeover of a national wildlife refuge by white-armed anti-government protesters in Oregon remains front-page news across the United States. Elsewhere, it's largely been eclipsed by such stories as the Iran-Saudi rift and turbulent economic markets. Still, some international media are seeing the story as offering a glimpse into the fraught issues of race and terrorism in the United States. In a column for Russia Today, American writer Robert Bridge, based in Moscow, asks whether mainstream media has gone soft on the Oregon militants because they don't fit the normal definition of a terrorist. Britain's Telegraph expands that theme, citing a rise in police violence against black protesters across the United States and faulting U.S. media and law enforcement for a racial double standard. Matt Cooper is political editor for Newsweek. He joins us with details about the standoff and what these people are seeking.
Their demands are a little incoherent, but basically they want the federal government to sort of turn more land back over to local control, and they want them to go easy on a couple of local ranchers who'd been convicted of violating federal law and burning some federal lands. So they're out there kind of stood off in about 30 miles from the nearest town, and law enforcement is kind of waiting them out.
From what we understand, there has been some limited contact between them and law enforcement. What sort of negotiations would be taking place in a situation like this at this point in time?
I think they're going pretty slowly. There are no hostages. And again, it's really 30 miles from the nearest town. It's kind of empty out there. So they're not really, don't seem to be in danger of hurting anyone, even though they say they're armed. At the moment, it's mostly just persuasion saying, you know, come on, you should leave. You know, I think as time goes on, more, you know, more pressure will be put on them to go. They seem to have cut the power to the building already. They'll probably start to block the roads in and out at some point. And they'll try to turn up the pressure and get these guys to move on.
And it's a very cold time of year there, too. So being out in the rural wilderness, it can't be very easy for a long period of time.
Right. I mean, these guys say they're prepared to stay indefinitely, but the fact is it's cold and they are in the middle of nowhere. And if they don't have power, it's going to be even more uncomfortable.
This brings up memories of other standoffs in the past in the United States, which did not end so well. There was one at Ruby Ridge and, of course, the infamous standoff in Waco, Texas, many years ago that ended up in the entire compound being burned.
Exactly. I mean, there's been a sad history of this in the U.S. Some of these have led, as you said, to a tragic loss of life. And in recent years, federal law enforcement has been much more cautious, much more patient in these kind of situations, much less likely to, you know, go in guns blazing, and more inclined to just wait these folks out. Reporters are just being allowed to kind of drive in there and interview them, so it's not like we don't see what's going on there to some degree.
That's one of the interesting aspects of the story, too, is the access of the eyes and ears of the media to show us what is happening.
Yeah, that's pretty rare in these kind of situations. I mean, it has happened before, but it is very unusual to have kind of a media dealing with these guys who are, you know, essentially criminals while law enforcement waits them out. But I think that's all part of the strategy of, like, letting these guys vent, let them get some TV time. And then, you know, then you squeeze them more to get them out of there.
Before we go, Matt, is there anything else that our audience might like to be aware of in this story?
Well, I think they should just know that this is part of an ongoing debate that's gone on in America for a long time about federal control of lands in the American West. In some states, up to a third, even 90% of a state's land is actually controlled by the federal government in Washington. And many locals have bristled about that over the years, and not just sort of, you know, renegades like these fellows, but, you know, there's been a legitimate debate about that, and that's not going to end anytime soon.
Well, Matt Cooper is political editor for Newsweek. You can read about what is happening in Oregon from his article online. Matt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
She's known for her role on the hit show Orange is the New Black, and she's also been a VJ for MTV and is the face of denim and supply clothing from Ralph Lauren. International Edition's David Byrd tells us about Australian Ruby Rose, who has been called an androgynous Angelina Jolie.
Ruby Rose says that she would not call herself a model. That's a strange thing to say for a young woman who has been featured in Vogue Australia, In Style magazine, Marie Claire, Clio, Cosmopolitan, and Maxim. Rose is best known as Stella Carlin on the hit Netflix show Orange is the New Black. Her androgynous character has been called a badass with a permanently arched brow and a Justin Bieber haircut. Ruby, who worked as an MTV VJ in Australia, was a judge on Australia's Top Model, and is the face of Maybelline Australia, says she never sought a modeling career.
But I'm definitely not a model. I mean, I've never really been one. It's definitely like everyone always says, oh, you know, model turn actress. And I was like, but I was never a model. I wish I was, but I was always too short and boy-like and had too many tattoos. But I think the acting is really what's taking up all my time, and that is a dream of mine. That's what I've always wanted. It's just taken me so many sidesteps to get to this position.
For the recent Ralph Lauren campaign, Rose teamed with model and friend Hailey Baldwin. The 29-year-old Australian says that the shoot was more organic, with photographer Mark Seliger working in a warehouse in Brooklyn.
It's very collaborative, so we kind of put our heads together and thought about what was authentic and real for me. And I have, like, a real love for street art and music and all things artistic. So we kind of put together a day in the life of, although it went for sort of 2 days, and just filmed what we would do naturally.
Ruby says that her androgynous style reflects how she feels comfortable, and she doesn't want to change her look just to please those around her.
I think that whether it's just timing, whether it's just really being true to myself and staying true to myself and not taking what people say to heart or being even really affected by it whatsoever is a really strong point of mine. So I haven't really felt that it's been difficult to stay true to myself.
Rose, who came out as a lesbian at age 12, says her role on Orange is the New Black has helped start a much-needed dialogue about gender role and identity, both in the entertainment industry and worldwide.
People were waiting to start this conversation. They just wanted somebody to start it. Someone had to ignite it, and then once that happened, it was just like a snowball effect where, you know, you had celebrities and all different people coming out and saying, I'm gender fluid, or, you know, I'm transgender, or people feeling more comfortable in their skin to be able to really just express that.
Though it's not definite that her character will be back on Orange is the New Black, Ruby Rose has two films on her schedule, John Wick 2 with Keanu Reeves, and Resident Evil, The Final Chapter. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. We're always found at our website, voanews.com, and we're out there on Twitter as well. Follow us at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter. Well, you guys can switch roles if you want. Engineer Zeynep Abdel-Rahman, you're both equally qualified. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We thank you so much for joining us. We hope you have a great day.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering rewards for information leading to 6 key leaders of the Somalia-based terrorist organization Al-Shabaab. The U.S. Secretary of State has authorized rewards of up to $6 million for information on the whereabouts of Abu Abeda Diriyah, up to $5 million each for information on Mahad Karate, Ma'alim Daoud, and Hassan Afguye, and up to $3 million each for information on Ma'alim Salman and Ahmed Imam Ali. Since 2006, Al-Shabaab has killed thousands of civilians, aid workers, and peacekeepers in Somalia, Uganda, and Kenya. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the July 11, 2010 suicide bombings in Kampala, Uganda, which killed more than 70 people, including one American citizen. Al-Shabaab also claimed responsibility for the September 21st through 24th, 2013 terrorist attack against the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi, which left more than 60 people dead and nearly 200 wounded, and the April 2, 2015 attack on Garissa University College in Kenya, which resulted in 150 deaths. The U.S. Secretary of State designated Al-Shabaab a foreign terrorist organization on March 18, 2008. In February 2012, Al-Shabaab and the Al-Qaeda terrorist network jointly announced they had formed an alliance. Abu Abeda, also known as Diriyah, was named the leader of Al-Shabaab on September 6, 2014, after the death of former Al-Shabaab Emir Ahmed Abdi Al-Mohammed, otherwise known as Godanye. Mahad Karate, also known as Abdirrahman Mohammed Warsameh, has played a key role in Al-Shabaab's assassination operations in the April 2nd attack on Garissa University College. Ma'alim Daoud is responsible for Al-Shabaab's planning, recruitment, training, and operations against the government of Somalia and Western targets. Hassan Afguye oversees Al-Shabaab's financial activities, ranging from fake charities and fundraising to racketeering and kidnapping. Ma'alim Salman leads Al-Shabaab's African foreign terrorist fighters and has been involved in attacks against tourists, entertainment establishments, and churches in Africa. Ahmed Imam Ali has recruited Kenyan youth and raised funds for Al-Shabaab. Anyone with information on these terrorist leaders should contact the nearest U.S. embassy or the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net. Individuals in North America can call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.